Tonight on Arena, Jared Harris on the exhibition of his father Richard's archive at Limerick's Hunt Museum, and Moya Cannon on her new poetry collection, Bunting's Honey. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. When Richard Harris died in 2002, he left behind more than a legacy of iconic film roles and larger-than-life stories. He also left behind a vast and personal archive rich with scripts, letters, photographs and mementos that map the course of a remarkable life. Now, more than two decades later, that archive has found a spiritual home at the Hunt Museum in Limerick, the city where Harris was, of course, born. For his son, the acclaimed actor Jared Harris, star of Mad Men, Chernobyl and The Crown, the exhibition is not just a tribute to his father's public career, but it also reveals the emotional complexity of a man often defined solely by his rebellious image. Absolutely delighted to have Jared Harris join me now from our Limerick studio. Sure, where else would you be other than in the Limerick studio, Jared?
Yes, it's an appropriate place for me to be right now.
It certainly is that. I was just thinking about, you know, what this archive reveals about your father. How irritating for you over the years was it, or when did it become irritating that when people said Richard Harris, you know, it was going to be a story about drinking, it was going to be a story about fighting, it was going to be a story about being a rebellious character on set. You know, you knew much a man who was much broader than that, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, it's still that way, mostly. Largely fueled by himself. So, but he was much, much, much more complicated and much richer than that. I think the thing that people would be surprised at is his public image wasn't as a sentimental person, but you can just see by the wealth of the stuff that he kept and from how far back it went that he cared deeply about all of these connections and this memorabilia and these little treasures that would spark memories in him, you know? I mean, for someone whose sort of reputation was, you know, he only lived life going forward and there was no looking back, that's not true. He brought a lot of that stuff with him.
What kind of things specifically in the exhibition that will be on show in the Hunt Museum, what kind of things, Jared, showed you that side of your father?
Well, there's one hilarious letter that he writes to his mother asking for money, as you do when you're young, and help. And he's in rehearsals for an Arthur Miller play, A View from the Bridge. And Arthur Miller has been coming to rehearsals every day, and occasionally he brings his wife with him, Marilyn Monroe. And he makes a point of saying he didn't see what all the fuss was about.
And he says he writes this in a letter to your mother.
Yeah, to his mother.
Oh, to his wife. Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah, sorry, to his mother, yeah. not to your mother.
Yeah.
Yeah, to his mother. And he was a young actor at that time.
That was his second job, I think. It was his second job. His first professional job was the choir fellow. And then based on that, I think it was Strasberg saw him in that and suggested him to Arthur Miller for the London production of A View from the Bridge.
Wow. Yeah.
And a small role. It was a small role.
Yeah. But nevertheless, as we all know, no such thing as a small role. There's only a small actor.
Well, yeah, he made sure he was noticed.
Yeah. Interesting that you say there about your father's reputation. A lot of it was of his own making. Just tease that out a little bit further for me.
Well, you know, you could see in some of the interviews that he would give, he would talk about that a lot. And and he was someone there who was deliberately trying not to follow in the footsteps of the traditional actor coming up through the English system, which was toeing the line and being polite and deferential. And he didn't want to do any of that. You know, he wanted to claim his space and he wasn't waiting for somebody to, you know, give him permission, if you like. And then at a certain point, it was selling newspapers. And when he had to, I mean, he used to say that when his films, the box office would drop for his movies in London, the producer would say, hey, listen, we need some help selling tickets, and he'd go out and do something outrageous, and they'd be over the front pages and the ticket sales would go up.
Well, that's interesting, because I have a clip here from the Dick Cavett show from 1971. You
know? I know it well.
Yeah, let's have a listen to the clip and what he says here. We've got to remember, on the set with Dick Cavett, obviously, this was the big chat show, and a bit like newspapers, they wanted the mad story. That's what they were looking for. That was what was going to pull in the audience ratings in some ways and the viewership numbers for them.
But you should probably mention that he had a very obvious mark on his face of an encounter that is clear from the moment he walks on stage.
Two big marks across his face.
Too big to ignore,
And right across the seat from him was sitting a bullfighter. Don't know what the bullfighter's name was, but he'd been talking to Dick Cavett earlier in the show. Yeah. But let's listen to Richard Harris describing how he got these two marks on his face.
No, I ran into a small bit of trouble last night.
Oh.
Small bit.
Yes. Well, could you give us any tips on how to avoid the kind of trouble you ran
into?
Well,
I don't know. I remember I keep, for some strange reason, I don't get paid for this. You get paid to fight those bulls, but I don't get paid for this. But I kind of, I spend some kind of, a large portion of my life in fights, I suppose. One tries to avoid them. Yeah. But I remember in New York, about the last time I did your show, actually, I was in New York, I got into a fight in a bar. And the thing was going, one word bothered another, there was a fight, a punch up and all that. But I thought, this is getting too rough for you, Harris, you're too old, you're 40, you can't do this anymore, you see? So I thought, well, the only way to do, the only thing I can do is get out of it. So the row started and I jumped over the bar and I hid behind the bar because punches were going like mad. And I hid behind the bar and I said, let them fight, you see? And there was a guy beside me, crouching too. And I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm ducking Harris. And the two fellas who started the fight were both under the bar, hiding behind the bar from each other, while everybody else was killing each other.
And that is Richard Harris in a 1971 Dick Cavett show on American TV.
It's interesting because, you know, Peter O'Toole's nickname for Dad was the Mixer.
That's interesting, because what interested me in that interview was I was watching a bit of it earlier on, and he starts off, if you care to listen to him, your father, by saying, I'm a born liar.
Yeah.
So he gives the warning. The health warning is out there if you care to pick up on it.
Yeah, but except that one is pretty obvious because he's got these giant cuts all over his face.
Yeah.
And Dick Cavett's very clever because he waits a really long time before he mentions it. And then he says this brilliant comment, off-the-cuff comment, where he says, listen, we need to talk about something. And Dad goes, yeah, I wondered when you were going to mention it. And Dick Cavett says, yes, I noticed that most of your face isn't marked.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant ad-lib. It was very clever indeed. But that is, I suppose, what this exhibition that you're talking to us about this evening, Jared, Dickie to Richard, Role of a Lifetime, which will be at the Hunt Museum from the 4th of this month. I suppose it's not that it wants to fight against that image, I don't think it wants to fight against that image. It just wants to show us other sides to the man that we don't often hear about. You mentioned sentimentality, that wonderful letter he wrote about Arthur Miller and Marilyn Monroe. But there are other things in there. Keeping all the wedding invitations to his wedding to your mother, old letters, as you said, to your parents as well. Were there things perhaps that were directly to you or to your brothers or things like that that really spoke to you and must have been quite difficult to look at?
There's a telegram from my mother to him after the release of his first album, A Tramp Shining, and it was with a couple of the songs about their breakup. And she says, you know, she's listened to the album and made her very sad, but congratulations. You know, they were friends for the whole of their life. They were never not friends with each other. They just couldn't live with each other, but they loved each other. And I was surprised he kept all of our letters from school, which some of them, I mean, you know, I've seen some of them and they're really embarrassing because all we're doing is asking for things. You know, please send money, please send sweets, please come and get me out of here.
And was there any point along the way, I know there was this idea within your own family that perhaps the law was going to be a career for you. I think you mentioned because you were an argumentative middle child.
Yeah, I was the middle child. I was always fighting my corner, yeah.
Did you kind of broach the subject of theatre with your father at any point?
No. I went to Duke University and I got into it there. And my mother came and saw me in Equus. It was in my second year there, at sophomore. And she told him, oh, you should go and see him. He's very good. And he said, well, you would say that. You're his mother. And he didn't come down until after I graduated. And I was doing a play in the summer after I graduated. And I'd made a movie as well, rashly. And he came down and saw the film in the afternoon and was going to tell me that's what you should pursue. And he saw the play in the evening, and I've never, ever forgotten. First of all, I never forgot the first laugh I got from him about 10 minutes into the play. And then the look on his face afterwards when I came out of the stage door and met him by the stage door. He was absolutely thrilled and excited and surprised. And there was a whole new world that he could share with me because it was something that we both had a passion for and were interested in. So that was the beginning of long dinners and chats when he would describe Olivier's, Coriolanus, Peter O'Toole in Brandt, famous productions that had really affected him, and he would describe them in detail and sometimes act them out, you know.
I'm wondering too, in terms of the archive and the exhibition that is there, this Sporting Life from 1963, really one of the films that launched your father's career, without any doubt. Obviously, it's a rugby theme. Obviously, it's very much, you can't think of Limerick City and Munster without thinking of rugby. Do we get any memorabilia from that aspect of your father's life? Because rugby is hugely important to him.
Oh yeah. There's a letter that he wrote there was a famous win for the club, and he wrote this letter to be printed in the newspapers. I think that somewhere in there, I'm not sure if it's here, there was a card sent to him by a student here asking him not to come to the Munster matches because he was bad luck. Or if he did come, could he borrow Harry Potter's Cloak of Invisibility? Yeah.
And wonderful that he would keep that sort of thing.
I'm saying he kept everything, he kept everything. That was really surprising because he didn't keep them in great condition either. Mm. I mean, they were thrown into suitcases and stuff like that, but it was all there.
And I believe, too, was there a letter towards the end of his life when he was actually quite sick, I think, from Daniel Radcliffe, Harry Potter himself,
yes,
wishing him well.
That's there, yeah.
Again...
I mean, they visited him in hospital. I mean, initially it was looking quite good. It was looking like he was going to get out of there. So a lot of people were visiting, and then it just suddenly took a turn for the worse over a period of a couple of weeks.
The other aspect, of course, of the Harry Potter thing was it was kind of a late flourishing in terms of your father's career. He made some very interesting choices. I suppose this would be into the 1990s. How much did he talk to you about those choices that I'm thinking of?
Obviously? Well, he got nominated for a second time in the 90s for The Field. There was a period there, the sort of decade before, where a lot of his time was spent touring Camelot around the world. The stage play. Mm. And that really was the reason why he was able to do the Pirandello play. And that's a weird thing to say, but he got his confidence back about being on stage. And he got his voice back and he got his stamina back. And that was why he was able to tackle the Pirandello play. And then every producer in London was throwing ideas at him. And he was, at one point, he was going to do a season of plays with Duncan Weldon and Thelma Holt, and he sort of committed to it. But he got nominated for The Field, and he got close. And then he kind of sort of got interested in trying to find another film role that would get him, would get him the award. And his focus got split. And then by the time Wrestling Ernest Hemingway came out, which is a really wonderful movie, and it didn't happen with that. He'd let that discipline slip enough, and he didn't go back on stage again, which was a pity because he had a lot to offer on stage.
Of course, you've made a return to the stage yourself in recent times.
Nice segue.
Well, you handed it to me, thank you. About 15 years off the stage, and then
yes,
back with Claudius.
No, it was the homecoming.
The homecoming, I beg your pardon.
And then this year it was, Claudius and Hamlet at the RSC. Yeah.
And Claudius and Hamlet at the RSC. But what I thought about when I heard about Claudius and Hamlet at the RSC was back to you as the 40-year-old Jared Harris playing Hamlet in a small production in the United States, I think. This would have been close enough to your father's death. Would he have been aware of the choices you were making at that time? Would you have discussed them with him?
No, he played the ghost.
Ah.
We filmed him as the ghost. And so we projected his image onto a scrim each night and he would appear. And so he absolutely knew. And he came and saw it.
And then what kind of discussions did you and he have?
I'd had loads of conversations about Hamlet with him already. And he had a very sort of particular take on a version of Hamlet that he wanted to do. He wrote it down in a screenplay. That's somewhere there in the archive. I don't think that's been, it hasn't been gone through yet. But because there's tons of stuff there that they're still archiving, I guess. That was one of his favourite subjects, was to sit there and talk about his interpretation of that play.
The other thing I wondered about, I mean, you've had such a success in terms of television in particular. We think of The Crown, we think of Chernobyl, we think of Foundation, which is on Apple TV Plus as well.
Season three drops July 3rd, July 11th.
There you go.
Just going to get a plug in there on Apple TV Plus.
Good, yeah. Well, if I can do a segue, you can do a plug. That's
thank you very much.
That's allowed, isn't it?
I think so.
But I wonder, I know this is pure conjecture, but what kind of roles could your father have played in this new world of, these long-form television pieces, which allow for more, I think one could argue, than modern-day cinema often allows for?
Well, I mean, there's probably some of the stories he wanted to tell would have fared better in that format, because there's different opportunities to pitch to an audience when you've got that kind of stuff as opposed to a 2-hour or 3-hour movie. But he wasn't satisfied unless he was playing the lead. He would have to have been the central character of the story.
And could you see him? In your own head, have you seen him?
It's a pity, because the part of Dumbledore got more interesting as you went from movie to movie, and it became a bigger and bigger role and a more central role to the story. And he would have enjoyed that very much.
Yeah, and you mean, famously, he said that he took on the part of Dumbledore because his granddaughter Ella would never have forgiven him had he not done it.
I think you're
inclined to say perhaps that is part of Richard Harris playing into the Richard Harris persona.
Well, I mean, it's not so much the persona as that he was a very canny person, So he knew that the premiere was going to be a big event. So he was, what happened was, I called him up. There's all the coverage about the premiere in London. And I called him up at the Savoy and I said, Dad, it's wall-to-wall coverage. It's huge over here. All the news outlets and everything are talking about it. And there's only two interviews they're showing. One is Daniel Radcliffe's and the other is you with Ella. And he goes, ah, great, it worked. Because he had tried to stage manage that red carpet a year and a half earlier by putting that story out. And he brought Ella onto the red carpet. So people would go, is this your granddaughter? Is she the one? Yes, she's the one. Yeah.
Well, that canniness, obviously, I'm not going to cast aspersions on the Midwest, but certainly the canniness of the Limerick man clearly coming out very strongly in that act. And the patience.
You said that, not me.
Yeah, I'm probably in trouble now. The patience, though, to wait that length of time. It shows something.
Well, it was again, that story about when he's been taken out of the Savoy Hotel and he props himself up on an elbow and he goes, it was the food. Look what your food has done to me. So when he gets into the ambulance with my mother, and he had been very sick in the room, and they had to really talk him into agreeing to get into the ambulance. He didn't want to be moved. And when he's in the ambulance with my mother, she starts laughing and goes, "You are terrible. You know, that hotel must be desperate to get you out of there." You know, and he looked at her and he said, "Now that no one can sell the story." Because he wanted to work and he didn't want a story to be told of Richard Harris wheeled out sick on a stretcher, and he didn't want anyone in the hotel to sell that story to the press. And now they couldn't, because there was a punchline and they were the butt of it.
Yeah, and how interesting that again he had that foresight to see how it would be portrayed in the newspapers and across television news, etc., etc. Let's have a listen to him in one of the late roles, and there's just something absolutely gorgeous about this as Marcus Aurelius with Russell Crowe as Maximus in Gladiator.
5,000 of my men are out there in the freezing mud. 3,000 of them are bloodied and cleaved. 2,000 will never leave this place. I will not believe that they fought and died for nothing.
And what would you believe?
They fought for you. And for Rome.
And what is Rome, Maximus?
I've seen much of the rest of the world. It is brutal and cruel and dark. Rome is the light.
Yet you have never been there. You have not seen what it has become. I am dying. Maximus, when a man sees his end, he wants to know there was some purpose to his life. How will the world speak my name in years to come? Will I be known as the philosopher, the warrior, the tyrant? Or will I be the emperor who gave Rome back her true self? There was once a dream that was Rome. You could only whisper it, anything more than a whisper. And it would vanish. It was so fragile. And I fear that it will not survive the winter.
And that is Richard Harris as Marcus Aurelius, Russell Crowe as Maximus from Gladiator. And Jared Harris is with me on the programme this evening talking about the upcoming exhibition From Dickie to Richard, Role of a Lifetime, an archival expression of the life of Richard Harris, which is at the Hunt Museum in Limerick. What a line. How will the world speak my name in years to come? It's very difficult not to think of your father as almost saying that of himself.
Well, that's one of those moments where roles meld with the actor and the life story of the actor and what we know of the actor. So that was definitely a thought that was on his mind at that point. Was because when he describes himself as that character, he could be talking about himself and all the facets of his personality.
And in those terms, why do you think that, I said at the very top of our conversation, your father is so often described solely in terms of that, you know, that rabble-rouser, that rebellious character?
Do you mean why is that?
Yeah, why is he not seen?
Because the press want to sell newspapers and he knew it, you know?
Yeah,
and now it would be clicks now. So it was that version of clickbait.
Yeah, it would be exactly. Yeah, likes would be enough. That would make them happy. But it is very difficult. I find it very difficult to listen to that line and not think of so much of himself. You know, I didn't know him in the way that obviously you would have as a son. But
things that we use that clip in the documentary, and one of the things that people come away from the documentary not knowing was that he had this huge singing career. And the poetry, and there was this other life to him. They would know him in his sort of his by reputation, then as an actor. But then you go, well, there was actually other facets to a career here that people weren't aware of.
Yeah, because as I was listening to that clip just now, it struck me how wonderful the language is within it. Now I know that's in the writing of the screenplay, obviously, but your father delivered it. How good is his poetry? When you're reading it as with your actor's head on, how good is it?
There's beautiful stuff in there. I mean, that his poetry, "Too Many Saviors," is still one of the most brilliant arguments against a sectarian divide, and like the argument about whose side God is on. And in the poem, God is saying, "I'm on neither of your side." You know, not if you're going to behave like this and fight like this. It's a fantastic poem.
Is there a one man show starring one Jared Harris of those of those poems?
I don't think so. You know who does a beautiful rendition of it? Stephen Ray. He did a wonderful for the documentary. Really wonderful, because it was so full of query and questioning and a sense of hurt. And my father's rendition of it came from a sense of anger and of disappointment. It was wonderful to hear these different options available to great actors when you give them that kind of material.
What are you hoping, Jared, people will take away from the exhibition that will be showing at the Hunt Museum? What sides of your father do you want people now to see that perhaps have been kept under the cloak of invisibility up until now?
How much he cared about his family history, his family from Limerick and their story. How much he cared about the lifelong love affair that he had with my mother, the love affair that he had with his second wife, Anne Tickell, the relationship he had with his children, the passion he had for his career, for his work, you know. He cared deeply about it. Our goal in putting the documentary together and getting them out is giving people an idea of the so many facets to his personality. And if people are interested, you can start doing your own deep dive, because it's all out there. A lot of this is out there on the internet. The other thing that I think people will be surprised at is how funny he is. Because there's a 10-minute section of his appearances on the American talk shows, and then there's another place where you can see his interviews on the Irish talk shows, but specifically the American ones, which people really wouldn't have seen over here. It's hilarious. He was very, very funny.
I want to finish, since you mentioned his singing career, because he could have been quite the singer if there was never any acting.
He was. I mean, he won Golden Globe. I mean, he won had Golden Records. He had number ones, number twos. His Didn't We and My Boy were covered by Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley. He had a hugely successful career as a pop singer.
Where does MacArthur Park sit in all of that for you?
I mean, it evokes an era. I mean, that, you know, that harpsichord piano was in the living room in Tower House, and we would all sit there and play chopsticks on it. And it was playing all the time. I remember seeing him on Top of the Pops, singing My Boy, walking around the garden in Tower House. That was a massive part of my memory of him.
Well, we should finish up, I think, then, with a little bit of MacArthur Park. And maybe you can play along on the desk down there in Limerick
with
chopsticks on the imagined harpsichord.
Bless you.
Jared, lovely to speak with you again.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for being with us on Arena this evening.
Thank you.
That's Jared Harris. And From Dickie to Richard, Role of a Lifetime, opens 4th of July at the Hunt Museum in Limerick, runs through until the 16th of November 2025. Huntmuseum.com for full details, and find out the parts of Richard Harris that you have never found out about before, and listen to him right now singing MacArthur Park.
That I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again. Oh no.
He certainly could sing, couldn't he? That's Richard Harris. Of course, the singing career took off after Camelot. And Jimmy Webb, who wrote hits like By the Time I Get to Phoenix and Wichita Lineman, it was Jimmy Webb who wrote that 7-minute suite called MacArthur Park. Everybody else rejected it. Richard Harris took it on. Number 2 in the Billboard Hot 100, number 10 in the Adult Contemporary Chart, number 4 in the UK. And before that, we were speaking to Jared Harris about the exhibition From Dickie to Richard running at the Hunt Museum, as I said. And by the way, that documentary that Jared Harris mentioned a few times is called The Ghost of Richard Harris. I believe it's available on Prime Video, and it features all three of the Harris sons. Jared, of course, the actor. Jamie, younger brother, also an actor, and older brother, Damien Harris, who is a filmmaker. Bunting's Honey is the seventh poetry collection from Moya Cannon, the Donegal-born poet who now lives in Dublin. Readers will know of Moya's lifelong interest in landscape, place and music, and the way all three and more things can carry a story. Moya is a member of Istana, recipient of the Brendan Behan Award and the O'Shaughnessy Award, and Bunting's Honey has been selected as a Poetry Book Society's Summer Recommendation, a recognition given to only a handful of new collections each season by the august UK body founded by T.S. Eliot. Delighted that Moya Cannon is with me in studio this evening. Bunting's Honey, it's such a great title for a collection, and there's a title poem in there about, it's Edward Bunting that we're talking about in this case, Moya. Not surprised that you should be interested in a collector of songs.
Yeah, well, he's a very, very interesting character, somebody I'd heard about many years ago, and he was a young man who collected the music of the last itinerant Irish harpers in 1792 at an assembly of harpers in Belfast. And I was delighted some time ago to have been commissioned by Quitchairn Harp Ireland, by Aileen McCran, to work with a young harper, a brilliant young harper from Clare called Aisling Lyons, to work on a piece which would celebrate the collaboration, traditional collaboration between poet and harpist in ancient Ireland. And anyway, I decided to work on a piece on Bunting's the assembly in Belfast, and it was fascinating researching it, because I discovered, I hadn't realised before, that this assembly was organised not quite as a sideshow, but in tandem with the meeting of the Irish Volunteers in 1792 to celebrate the third anniversary of the French Revolution. And it was organised, the harp part of it was organised by an inspired young doctor called James MacDonald from the Glens of Antrim. And he sent out a notice, he advertised, he raised funds through a group of mostly Presbyterian businessmen in Belfast, and he commissioned young Edward, 19, to collect the music.
I was struck, it's quite a lengthy poem, the title poem. You're going to read the closing section of it, but one of the things that struck me in the opening section, you talk about these harpers that were part of the conference and part of the collecting process that Bunting was involved in. Six of the 11 harpers were blind harpers. Something that it really struck me, you know, that here we had the seers, if you like, ironically being these blind harpers.
Yeah. Well, it was, a lot of them came from sort of families which had been very respectable, not quite nobility before, but smallpox was very common. And blindness was a side effect of smallpox. And very often, if a child was blind, he was trained, usually he, though there were women as well, trained up as a harper so that he would have a livelihood.
Yeah.
And was sent on the road usually with a boy and a horse to travel the roads of Ireland and to visit the houses of both the old nobility and the remains of them and the new.
Yeah, in fact, there's definitely, you mentioned one of the women here, Rose Mooney was one of the blind harpers. She's mentioned within the poem. You're going to read the closing section of Bunting's Honey for us.
Yes, indeed. Gentry of the first fashion from Belfast and its environs, pay half a guinea to listen and look on with attention. And Theobald Wolfe Tone looks in, but his mind is on revolution. Decades before young Edward Bunting dies, a great French empire will rise and fall. Wolfe Tone's revolution will have failed. Yet Bunting's life will still be held in thrall by this treasure he garners in the exchange hall. But now the harpers, mostly old, display to each other and salvage airs which remember and relay griefs, gaieties and passions of spirits long parted from their clay. For what do a musician's hands ever hold but the hammered treasure of the human soul?
Moya Cannon there with the closing section of the title poem from her new collection, Bunting's Honey. And as I said, Moya, it's hardly surprising that you would be interested in a song collector and in songs. I'm thinking of Carrying the Songs, which was your third collection, if I remember correctly. Donegal Tarantella, a more recent collection. Always that idea that songs and dances and our culture can actually carry a kind of a memory of the entire community.
Well, I mean, it carries a community's soul, doesn't it? You know, and I mean, long before we had literature, before we had writing, We had song, we had visual art, we had dance, and it's what brings people together. I mean, the very earliest human beings had visual art, and I think we gather together around beauty.
Yeah, and that is part of this collection as well. Yeah. Your travels around various places and works of art that you're watching.
Yeah.
But there was one thing, that another poem that really struck me was Duchess. Very difficult word to translate in terms of Irish. It can mean, there's so many meanings, I suppose, you know, the natural side of things and your heritage, all of that. But this goes right back to your own mother.
Yes, it was just, I'm very interested in place names.
And what they carry, I guess.
And what they carry, just the history of a place. Some of them are descriptive, some of them associated with mythology. But also the way they carry the emotional weight of events which have happened in them. And I'm also just interested in etymology and words themselves. And Duchess was one of those words, very difficult to translate. As you say, it means heritage. It means, you know, the chant or duchish. It means where you come from, etc. And I was born in Donegal, but my mother was originally from Tyrone, and she spoke so warmly of the area she came from. And we visited as children until the trouble started, and then sort of a place which had been, it just changed completely. And I'm so aware of it just at the moment, when so many places where people are carrying on their lives relatively pleasantly, just troubles come down on them, much more severe than perhaps in the north of Ireland. But there were terrible times there as well. So
let's have a listen to a little bit of Duchess, because it starts with such joy and lovely warm glow off.
Yes, yeah. Duchess. Sweet Tyrone among the bushes, the rock 6 mile cross, Loch McCrory. She spoke the names affectionately, all the consonants softened, all the vowels lengthened. Pomeroy, Beara, Oma. Hamlets, villages, towns that had surrounded her childhood. To us children, summer holiday names almost as exotic as Samarkand, but we sometimes wondered which rock among so many, 6 miles from where, who was McCrory and how did he get his own lake, and later, what king and why an apple? But later still, those names shrilled. Night raids, armed soldiers shouting in the kitchen of our small favourite aunt, bewildered young cousins interned, armoured cars and murderous nighttime roadblocks, and then a bombing, heinous, catastrophic. What's in a place name? A hill where a glacier paused, exhausted. A rise or hollow where the earth's crust crumpled, a stony, embattled river crossing. Is it power, dramatic incident, or primal poetry that allows specific syllables first stick to field, forest, house or hill, before life and time play on them to ring joy bells or knells of dread inside our heads? And can place names, once maybe tenderly spoken, Wounded Knee, Zveda, Babi Yar, Hiroshima, Kosovo, Kabul, Bucha, Oma, ever be cleansed of their pain? And what's in any name? What does Omphalos mean, or Duchess? What does Duchess mean? And why has such violence been wreaked in its gentle name?
Moya Cannon with her poem Duchess from her new collection, Bunting's Honey. I was struck, it's divided up into five sections, the collection, Moya, and when you get into the fifth section, it really becomes very contemporary. It had a very contemporary feel of it to me. One poem, The Slaughter of the Innocents, seems like a direct reference to Palestine for me.
It is indeed, yes.
Yeah, a section in it where you talk about sort of a friend speaking to you about four doctors who...
Three young brothers. They were all doctors, and they were all killed within 2 weeks. They'd been working in hospitals. It was about 6 or 9 months ago.
Yeah, and it was written on the 24th of December, Christmas Eve, and obviously that reference to the slaughter of the innocents going back to biblical times.
Yes.
On the page preceding that, a reference directly to Ukraine. Am I right?
That's right, Sean. Yeah. It's at the beginning of the war in Ukraine. My friend Ava Burke, who would have been born in really not terribly long after the Second World War, and we began to see the vision of the people fleeing, the women and children, and said, "Oh no, it's all starting again," you know, and you know, all the men basically being you know, allowed to, or asked to stay at home, not quite conscripted at that stage, you know, and people who were guys who were just trying to do an ordinary day's work, whatever, having to become heroes, etc. And just the terrible distortions of life that war brings and the useless tragedy. And we kind of, I don't know, growing up in the 60s, I suppose we thought that maybe we'd evolved
past this. No,
and to be thrust back into it now, and for people not to be able to imagine peace again, because it will come. I mean, the treaties will be signed eventually, but at what a cost.
Yeah, how many lives have to go first? Will you finish with "And Now the Babies"?
I will indeed. Thank you. "And now the babies. And now the babies and their mothers and their folded buggies hurry west in trains. And fathers, husbands, brothers must all become heroes again. And on both sides, the dark green munitions pile high again. And again, old Mother Courage rattles her old bloodied cart. And although long ago we held hands and sang, no one can remember again, no one can figure out again how to give peace a chance."
Maya Cannon with her poem "And Now the Babies", which is from her new collection Bunting's Honey, which is published by Carcanet Poetry. If you're referring back to our interview earlier with Jared Harris, "Went to MacArthur Park, it's tiny, in 1970, says Brona. And Alan Carroll, the late Jerry Ryan, told a great story about Richard Harris reading to Jerry's kids a story late at night in the banquet hall in Drumoland. That story painted a great picture. And thank you for those texts. The Women's Prize for Nonfiction, only in its second year, was awarded to Dr. Rachel Clark for her book The Story of a Heart. In it, she focuses on the detail of one extraordinary heart transplant from a little girl called Kira to a little boy called Max, and the impact it had on their families, but also on organ donation in general. Delighted that Dr. Rachel Clark, the author of three previous memoirs and who worked as a broadcast journalist before studying medicine as a mature student, is joining me on the programme this evening to talk about this book. The two children, even as I say their names, I find it hard to get through that, to be honest with you, Rachel. Kira and Max. Kira in particular, and what she gave to Max, that's at the heart, no pun intended, of this book.
Yes, absolutely. And when I first came across this story, which I did in a newspaper back in 2017, it just stopped me on my tracks, because Kira was a beautiful little girl. She was 9 years old, tragically in a car crash, and had catastrophic brain injuries. At the same time, Max, who was also nine, had been in a hospital on the transplant list for nearly a year, desperately unwell, with a heart that wasn't working. And his parents were sort of living with the knowledge that almost at any time he was sick enough to die. And when Kira's family were asked about donation, they didn't hesitate. In fact, Kira's little sister herself raised the topic, and she said to the intensive care doctor, "Can we donate her organs?" And ultimately, Kira's heart saved Max's life, and her other organs saved another child, another two adults. And there was publicity around this case, which led to Kira's mum working out that her heart had probably saved Max.
Gone to Max.
It is
extraordinary, that aspect of the story, because the usual situation here is that the donor and the recipient of the organ, they remain apart from each other. They remain anonymous to each other. For obvious, there are lots of reasons why we can understand that. But Kira's mother, Luana, decided to follow through and to contact Max's parents.
Yes, and normally the recipient families and people who receive organs, they can write letters expressing their thanks, and families love that, but their identity isn't revealed. But in this case, there was a campaign to change the law around organ donation. And so Max ended up on the front page of the Mirror newspaper. And that's what led Luana to work out what had happened. Yeah. And she sent a private message on social media to Max's mum, and it simply read, "I think you may have our daughter's heart, and it's the most beautiful heart in the world." And this culminated in the family's meeting and Kira's mum, dad, brother and sisters all listening with a stethoscope to her heart beating inside the chest of the little boy she had saved.
It's an extraordinary movie. It's an extraordinarily moving image, the thought of the family being able to do that. I mean, when the child is in the womb and when parents hear that heartbeat for the first time, it's such a moment of total exuberance and joy to hear that heart beating inside the womb. What must that moment have been like for Luana and the rest of Kira's family? Extraordinary.
Absolutely. And I interviewed everybody involved in this story. So Kira's family, Max's family, Max himself, and then all the NHS staff who did this amazing work behind the scenes to make the transplant happen. And Kira's dad, Joe, says that every single day of his life, he thinks about the incredible thing that Kira did. And he is so proud of her and knowing that she is living on with this literally living legacy, a death-defying legacy in Max and the other people she saved, gives him great comfort.
I can imagine. And Max, I believe, every morning says hello to his heart, says hello to Kira's heart within his body, which is a lovely quality that clearly he has as a young teenager now.
Yes, it's beautiful. So the letter that he wrote to Kira's family in the first place, he said he says hello to the heart every morning and he's trying to make sure it has a really lovely home to settle down into, which is beautiful. And today he's this towering 16-year-old who is just living life to the full. He's just finished his GCSEs. But every day he thinks of Kira and her family. And it's an extraordinary thing for a teenager to have to think of, but also incredibly beautiful. I think that more than anything, the book is a story of altruism and kindness and goodness. And I think that Max and his family and all of us could do with remembering in a pretty scary world at the moment, just quite how good and kind and generous people can be.
Absolutely. And the other thing that struck me, and I wondered had you thought about this, because to a large extent what the book goes into is, you know, the history of organ transplant and particularly of heart transplants and the risks that doctors and surgeons had to take in the early days, the chance of the people that were lost, obviously, in learning the techniques that are now in many ways not quite taken for granted, but certainly are much more commonplace than they would have been 15, 20, 30 years ago. I wondered to what extent, the heart is such an important organ in terms of the body physically, and you as a medical person would have thought about that side of things. But did you think also about, I suppose, the metaphors around the heart and how the heart is the where we locate love? It's where we locate all of those emotions within our lives as well.
Absolutely. And although we know today in the 21st century that our emotions and so on live in the brain, we still talk about and feel as though our hearts are the soul of us, the heart of us is where our emotions reside. And in a way, that's very understandable, because if you think about being frightened, for instance, and all of those metaphors, our heart jumped out of our chest. Yeah. We feel emotions. Your heart flutters when you meet someone you fancy. Your heart breaks if you're bereaved. And so because we actually feel emotions in our heart when our heart races, that's adrenaline, and we feel that in our body. So we have this incredibly emotional link to our heart, and it leads to wonderful things. For example, one of Max's best friends, a little boy from school, came to visit him in hospital. He wanted to know if Max would still love fish fingers after his heart transplant.
Because he knew
heart.
Maybe,
yes. And when the first person in the world had a heart transplant, a South African man, his wife said to Christian Barnard, the surgeon, in all seriousness, she said, will he still love me after his transplant? It's a fascinating part
it is a wonderful
history.
One thing that I wanted to touch on, I mean, this is obviously the Women's Prize for Nonfiction, and you do give us some statistics, or you have given us statistics around you know, how women's nonfiction is reviewed or not reviewed, as the case may be. And obviously this prize is very important in that respect. But I noticed that Breathtaking, which was a memoir, your memoir of a time when you were working on the, or people working on the front line of the health services during the COVID-19 epidemic, that went on to become a drama. With Joanne Froggatt, if I remember right, playing the part in it. Was it very different moving it from that, and you were involved in the adaptation, moving it from a memoir into that fictional world?
It was an amazing process, and I was very, very lucky because Jed Mercurio was the driving force behind the adaptation, and he's very well known for Line of Duty, probably more than anything. And it was actually wonderful for me because I sat down and for the first time had the challenge of turning a real story, all of my real experiences and those of my colleagues, into a fictional dramatic form. And I absolutely loved it. And in a way, it was very, it wasn't too dissimilar to writing nonfiction because Jed and I, we had a fundamental principle that everything that people saw on screen had to be true in some sense. It had to have really happened to some patient somewhere. And that felt very important, that we were showing the public what it was truly like inside our hospitals in that terrible time. But it was wonderful, the creative aspect.
I just want to finish up by mentioning the fact that it was to be Max's Law, this idea of opting out of organ donation, which we have here in Ireland as well. But Max insisted that it not be called Max's Law, that it be called?
Yes, Max and Kira's Law. So Kira is immortalised now in English law forever. And I guess if there is one thing I hope that your listeners might take from this, it's please, please, please talk to your loved ones about organ donation. Yeah. Ask your kids what they would feel, because the worst is very unlikely to happen. But if something this good could come from the worst, it's very, very precious and life-saving.
You could find yourself needing the donation as much as giving the donation. It's important to mention that. Thank you so much for being with us this evening, Rachel. That's Dr. Rachel Kirk. The Story of a Heart, winner of the Women's Prize for Nonfiction, is published by Abacus. That is our lot for this Wednesday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. James Feeney was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here in RT Radio 1. Apologies to John Creedon, who'll be with you after the news.